Chapter 5. The glass fell, the wind rose, and although Jack Aubrey couldn't drive his ship as hard as he would have done with a well-equipped dockyard under his lee, he took her to the uttermost limit of what he, with his intimate knowledge of her power, thought reasonable. The wind was uncommonly welcome, to be sure, but there was too much east in it, and too much rain for anything resembling comfort. Day after day the Surprise sailed on a taut bowline, tack upon tack under a low racing sky across a sea as grey and white-capped as the Channel, though as warm as milk and phosphorescent by night. She ran fast, generally under double-reefed topsails and the array of staysails that Jack had found best to her liking. Yet, with both wind and sea inconstant, this called for very close attention, and her captain was on deck most of the time, as wet as a man could well be. Next to the actual pursuit of an enemy, this was the kind of sailing he liked best, and if it hadn't been for his anxiety about the gunroom, he would have been perfectly happy. He shook out a reef whenever he could, and often, as the ship responded with even greater life, leaning over and throwing her bow wave broader still, the white water tearing aft and reeds, strangled voice calling, 10 knots, 1 fathom, sir, if you please, he felt a surge of whole-hearted joy. He worked his officers and men very hard indeed, but they were used to it. The Surprise had sailed as a privateer, and most of her people were privateersmen who sailed more for the profit than the glory. And when Jack started beating to windward with such zeal, they smiled at one another and nodded. In the ordinary course of events, when Captain Aubrey was sailing his ship from one place to another without a leading wind, he rarely tacked, but rather wore her. That's to say, he didn't bring her up to the wind as close as ever she could be, clap his helm a lee, swing her head right up into the wind's eye and beyond, so that she filled on the other tack, but, on the contrary, he let her fall right off, present her stern to the breeze, and so come round the other way. Wearing was slower, since the ship had to turn through 20 points of the compass rather than 12. It looked somewhat old womanish, and it lost a certain amount of windward distance, but it was much safer, and it called for fewer hands and less violent exertion, whereas tacking, above all in a strong wind and a heavy sea, put spars and sails in danger, as well as requiring the presence of both watches. They smiled even more when he spread so much canvas that even Pullings looked anxiously at him before relaying the order. They were very well acquainted with their skipper, an extraordinarily successful prize-taker, who dropped on his prey apparently by intuition, and they were convinced that somehow he'd got wind of a merchantman somewhere to the east. A seaman like Captain Aubrey would never gain a little windward distance by tacking in such a sea unless his chase had a beast in view, and they answered the frequent pipe of all hands about ship and the subsequent hard labour with perfect goodwill. "Helms a lee!" they heard that huge, familiar voice roar from the quarter-deck, and instantly, in darkness or fine weather, they let go the foresheet, foretopmast, staysails and jib-sheets, and waited for off-tacks and sheets, upon which those at their due stations let go the main-tack and sheet and all the staysail tacks and sheets abaft the foremast, passing the sheets over the stays. Then came mainsail haul, and once she was round, with the main tack down and the breast backstay set up, let go and haul. Furious activity as the foretack and head bowlines were raised, the yards braced about just so, the bowlines hauled with the cry of 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, belay oh! Some wet officer would hail the quarter-deck, "Bowlines haul, sir!" The order to coil all gear would come back in reply, and the watch below would pad off to drip through their hammocks in the steaming Turkish bath atmosphere of the lower deck. His officers were of the same opinion. They too had served under him in the same privateering line, and since the ship as a letter of marque had carried no midshipmen, they were perfectly accustomed to going aloft as reefers. In recent months, however, they'd grown soft, and now Jack rode them hard. "Mr. West there, should you like your hammock sent up? Mr. Davidge, pray jump into the foretop again. The aftermost starboard dead-eye is far from what it ought to be." His voice became terrible to them. The heavy weather brought its crop of injuries, and the sick berth had a number of sprains, cracked ribs, broken bones, and a hernia, which, together with the usual burns caused by lurching against the galley stove on those days when it could be lit, kept Stephen, Martin, and Padine busy, and allowed some interesting developments of the Basra treatment. Stephen's little girls, Sarah and Emily, were extraordinarily useful at a time like this. They were not in the least offended or surprised by the more squalid aspects of a sick berth. They'd been brought up to dissecting and to keeping Jemmy Duck's quarters clean, and neither in their remote Melanesian island nor aboard the Surprise had they had a pampered nursery life. Now they carried, fetched, kept the sick men company, comforted, and gave them more informed news of the outside world than could be drawn from the medicos. To the foremast jacks they talked forecastle English, seaman's English, with a broad West Country burr. "Skipper all down the main topmast, staysail at one bell. But, says he, we'm going to have another hatful of wind more easterly soon, so do he stow it in the fore cat harpings and pass a girt old gasket round." And quarterdeck English to Stephen and Martin. "Sir, Jemmy Duck says he's going to ask old Chucks." "Now, Sherry, where's your manners?" asked William Lamb, quartergunner, in an aside. "Beg pardon," said Sarah. "He's going to ask Mr. Bulkley, the boatswain, to suggest to the captain that hatches might be battened down. We're all a swim forward, and he's afraid for the sitting hen." "Battened down," said Martin. "There's a term I've heard again and again, like bitter end and laid by the lee, without ever really understanding it. Perhaps, sir, you'd explain them?" "Certainly," said Stephen. The seamen uttered no word. Their vacant expressions betrayed nothing. Only two exchanged covert glances. "Certainly. But in these cases, one drawing is worth a thousand words, so let's walk upstairs and find paper and ink." Hardly were they at the door, attended by Padine, than there were cries on the ladderway, and Reed was passed down pouring with blood. A falling block had struck him, so that he fell onto the marlin spike poised in his hand. It was awkwardly wedged between his ribs, and he was half fainting with the pain. "Hold him just so, and sit on the step," said Stephen to Bondon, who was carrying the boy. "Padine, two chests into his cabin, and the great lantern this living minute." The two chests were lashed together, forming a table. Reed lay on his back on a spare stunsel with his mouth tight shut, his breath coming fast and shallow. The surgeon looked down in the strong light, swabbing away the blood, gently feeling the spike and the wound and the crepitation of bone. "This is going to be extremely painful," said Stephen in Latin. "I shall fetch the poppy." Hurrying below, he unlocked the hidden laudanum, poured a strong dose into a phial, caught up some instruments and ran back. Once there, he cried, "Padine, now fetch me the long ivory probe and two pairs of retractors." And as soon as Padine was gone, he raised the boy's head and poured the dose into his mouth. For all Reed's fortitude, tears were running fast. Jack Aubrey was at the door. "Come back in half an hour," said Stephen. Half an hour, and the waves of pain rose and fell, reaching a shocking height, before Stephen withdrew the splinter, pressing on a thoracic nerve. Reed lay there, inert now, pale, running with sweat. "There now, my dear, the worst is over," said Stephen in his ear. "I've not seen a braver patient." And to Jack at the door, "With the blessing he'll do. heartily glad of it, said Jack. I shall look in again at 8 bells. By 8 bells, Reed had drifted off, and Stephen stepped to the door when he heard Jack's step. After a few low words, Jack said, Mrs. Oakes asks whether you would like her to sit up with him tonight. Will I first see how he comes along? I do, said Jack. And may he have a cot rather than his hammock and 2 strong men to lift him in? At once. The cot was slung. Bondon and Davies, bracing themselves with infinite care against the heave of the sea, raised the boy on his taut sailcloth, lowered him so gently that he never stirred, and walked silently out. Stephen returned to his seat, musing on a variety of things. The presence of a highly developed olfactory system in albatrosses, its paradoxical absence in vultures, the easier motion of the ship, her less urgent voice, the situation in the gun room. And at 2 bells, Reed said in a sleepwalker's voice, I doubt we're making more than 8 knots now. Listen, my dear, said Stephen, should you like Mrs. Oakes to sit by you a while? Mrs. Oakes. Oh, said Reed. After a long pause, he went on, They go in and out of that door like a bawdy house. I see them from here. Turned his head away and drifted off again. When Jack returned, Stephen told him that a medical hand was still required, that the patient should be moved downstairs tomorrow, if possible, for constant attention, and that Martin would relieve him in less than an hour. Surely the tempest has disarmed, he said, walking into the lamplit cabin. The noise up here is less by half, and I climbed the stairs with barely a stagger. The breeze has been dropping steadily, said Jack, and after the last downpour, Lord, how it did pelt, splashing from the deck up to your waist and gushing from the lee scuppers like a fire engine. If we'd not battened down quite early, you would have had a sopping bed. After the last downpour, the sky cleared. But tell me, how's the boy? He is fast asleep and snoring. The wound itself was not very grave, pleura untouched, and extracting the marlin spike was of no great matter, but it had driven a splinter of rib hard against the nerve, and withdrawing that was a delicate business. Now that it's out, however, he ought to be comfortable enough, and unless there should be infection, which is happily rare at sea, we may see him walking about quite soon. The young are wonderfully resilient. I'm delighted to hear it. And I dare say you'll be delighted to hear that we know where we are. Tom and I had 2 beautiful lunars, the one on Mars, the other on Fomalhaut. If the wind hadn't hauled round a little north of east, we might have made the Friendly Isles tomorrow. You'll never tell me, for all love, that you've been careering over this stormy ocean like a mad bull day and night without knowing where you were. And if you'd run violently upon an island, friendly or not, where would you have been then, your soul to the devil? There is dead reckoning, you know, said Jack mildly. Shall we have something to eat? How happy that would make me, cried Stephen, suddenly conscious that he was clemmed, pinched and wasted with hunger. Which is the best part of the hen that died, said Killick, in one of those inferior pantomime appearances they knew so well. And since the galley stove is still hot, you might fancy a little broth to wet your biscuit first. Broth and chicken, what joy, said Stephen. And when Killick had left, he went on, Tell me, Jack, just how would you explain the term battened down? A piercing look showed Jack that, although this was almost past believing, he was not, in fact, being made game of, and he replied, First, I should say that we talk very loosely about hatches, often meaning hatchways and even ladderways. He came up the fore hatch, which, of course, ain't hatches at all. The real hatches are the things that cover the hatchways, gratings and clothes hatches. Now, as you know very well, when a great deal of water comes aboard, either from the sea or the sky or both, we cover those real hatches with tarpaulins. I believe I've seen it done, said Stephen. Not above 5,000 times, said Jack inwardly, and aloud, and if it also comes on to blow and rain uncommon hard, we take battens, stout laths of wood that fit against the coaming, the raised rim of the hatchway, and so pin the tarpaulin down drum tight. Some people do it by nailing the batten to the deck, but it's a sad, sloppy, unseamanlike way of carrying on, and we have cleats. I'll show them to you first thing in the morning. For seamen, first thing in the morning meant that dismal hour at the fag end of an old and weary night when elm tree pumps and head pumps flood the already sodden forecastle, upper deck and quarter deck with water, and the still sleep-sodden hands move aft in gangs, sanding, holystoning, sweeping and flogging more or less dry. For some seamen it also meant the time when Reed, still bleary with opium, was carried down to a shelter extension of the sick berth, there to be watched by Padeen. For Stephen, however, it meant first thing in the Christian day. And it was in this sense that Oakes came below with the captain's compliments and would the doctor like to see the cleats they'd spoken of. He was a pale, silent, dangerous-looking man now. No longer an oafish, overgrown youth. But he managed a smile for Stephen and added, "You might see something else, too." The something else was a mildly ruffled sea, unvarying Prussian blue, almost to the horizon, under a pure, pale sky. The sun just clear of the eastern ocean, the moon sinking into it on the other hand, and on the starboard bow a low, domed island of some size, far off but already as green as a good emerald in that slanting light. The breeze, blowing directly from this island, was so faint that it scarcely whispered in the rigging, nor filled the towering array of sails with any firm conviction. Yet it seemed to Stephen that the air brought the scent of land. "Where is the captain, Verber?" he asked a seaman on the gangway. "He's at the masthead, sir." So, it appeared, was everyone else who could command an eminence and a telescope. Hammocks had not yet been piped up, but the watch below had come on deck of their own accord, and there they were, gazing at the distant island with great satisfaction, saying very little. Six bells, and John Brampton's spell at the wheel was done. He was a young smuggler and privateersman from Shelmerston, one of the Sethian persuasion, but less rigid than his fellows, and in his cheerful way he called out, "Good morning, sir," as he went forward. "Good morning, John," Stephen replied. And pausing, Brampton asked him whether he didn't admire the captain. "Never out. We knew he wasn't cracking on for sport, and there she lies." "Where, where?" "Right in with the island. Uncle Slade with his spyglass and the forejack crosstrees made her out directly when the sun lit up her sails. You can't deceive the captain." He was still laughing when he seized the foremast shroud and ran up to join his uncle. "Good morning, Doctor," said Jack, reaching the deck by way of a backstay, his boyish agility making an odd contrast with his worn face. "What news of Reed?" "He's doing well so far," said Stephen. "No fever. Some discomfort, but no very grievous pain. He can lie easy. Mr. Martin is with him now in the sick berth." "I'm so glad," said Jack. "And I beg pardon for being aloft when I sent word. A sail had been sighted. But, however, you're to come to see these cleats. Shall we step down to the upper deck? Would you first tell me about this island and your sail?" "Why, it's Captain Cook's Anamooka, exactly where he set it down." "One of the Friendly Isles?" "Just so. Didn't I mention it last night?" You did not, but I rejoice to hear it. And what of your sail? It's right in with the shore. From the masthead you can see it tolerably well with a glass. A European vessel, almost certainly a whaler. I saw a school of 20 blowing at first light. How I hope you'll sail straight in, take your prize and trot us ashore for a thorough examination of the island's flora, fauna and coffee shop, sir, said Killick. Shall we go down? Asked Jack. And on the upper deck he showed Stephen the after hatchway, its combing and its cleats. A pin passed through this hole across the cleat, you see, and grips the batten tight. It was not my invention, but my predecessor's. You remember Edward Hamilton? They believe not. Oh, come, Stephen, Sir Edward Hamilton, who commanded the Surprise when she cut out the Hermione. The man who was dismissed the service for seizing his gunner up in the rigging. Must you not seize a gunner up in the rigging? Oh, dear me, no. He's protected by his warrant, just as you are. Anyone else you may seize up and flog, too. But all you can do to an officer that holds a warrant or a commission is to confine him to his cabin until he's brought to a court-martial. Hamilton was well with the Prince of Wales, however, and he was reinstated quite soon. It's whimsical enough to think the two captains of the Surprise should have been struck off and then brought back. Jack had invited Pullings and Oakes to breakfast, and since service matters were allowed to be discussed at this meal, the westward currents, the tide, the adverse breeze, the probable nature and nationality of the distant sail, the frigate's urgent need of water, livestock, vegetables and coconuts were canvassed, together with the desirability of intensive work on all the rigging, running and standing. But Jack did talk about other things, and he did ask after Mrs. Oakes. "She's very well, sir, I thank you," said Oakes, flushing. "But she stumbled against a locker in the heavy weather, and she means to keep to her cabin for some time." Stephen excused himself quite early. Apart from anything else, this was as dull a breakfast as Jack had ever given. The host himself in poor spirits, despite his landfall. Guests obscurely oppressed, somehow shifty. Martin, relieved by Padine and the little girls at Eight Bells, was already at the rail. "I give you joy of the Friendly Isles," he said, "and of the prospect of a noble prize. All the hands who have made the journey to the main Jack Crosstrees assure me that she's an American whaler, very deep laden with spermaceti and no doubt great quantities of ambergris. Do you suppose the captain means to go straight for her in the Nelson fashion, take her and give us a run on the island? How I hope so. So indeed do I. What mind is indifferent to a prize? And in addition to this splendid prize, a week of walking about on Anamooka, that indeed would be bliss. I believe it has a very curious chestnut-coloured cuckoo and some rails, while the people are as amiable as can be, apart from a certain thievishness. I've heard that there's an owl in the Friendly Isles," said Martin. "There she blows," cried Stephen, together with a score of his shipmates. The familiar, forward-pointing single jet, 100 yards to windward, was followed by a black surging as the whale turned and dived, an ancient, solitary bull with a lacerated tail. "An owl, Nathaniel Martin? An owl in Polynesia? You amaze me." "I heard it on good authority. But here's the boatswain, who's been to Tongatabu no great way off. Mr. Bulkley," calling down into the waist, "did you see any owls in Tongatabu?" "Owls? God bless you, sir," replied the boatswain in his carrying voice. "There was one tree near the watering place, so thick with owls you could hardly tell which was tree and which was owls. Purple owls." "Did they have ears, Mr. Bulkley?" asked Martin, as one who doubts the value of his question. "That I cannot take my oath on, sir, and I should hazard a lie if I said yea or nay." "Ears or no ears," said Stephen after a while, "I fear it will be long before ever we see either prize or fowl. Quite early, Captain Aubrey used that ominous, ill-sounding word, still. The ship could still be seen from a certain lofty point. And at breakfast he explained to me that not only was this wind, this breeze, this poxed, half-hearted zephyr breathing directly from the island to us, but that in addition to an adverse but presumably temporary tide, there was also a permanent current bearing us to the west. He said it was by no means impossible that we should beat to and fro, perpetually receding, in spite of all our efforts. See how the men brace the yard a little sharper and haul on the bowline? Such zeal! They dearly love a prize. So do I, said Martin. I don't believe I could be called a worshipper of mammon, but prize money is different. And I'm now like the tiger that has once tasted human blood. Yet I hope the captain was making game of you, as the boatswain was almost certainly making game of me just now. It may well be. But I remember how we have lain to or sailed up and down trying to get into a port before this, or even out of one for weeks on end, hungry, thirsty, and discontented. Let us not be dismal, however. Let us suppose that we shall sail in tomorrow, butcher the whalers to a man, take their goods from them, and carry our butterfly nets and collecting cases into those verdant groves. The Surprise sailed gently on, slanting in towards Anamooka. And as they leant there on the rail, gazing out over a sea that had now turned a royal blue, with lighter paths wandering over its smooth surface, and talking of their earlier expeditions and their hopes of those soon to come, it seemed to Stephen that he had the old Martin at his side, open, ingenuous, amiable. How the change had come about, Stephen couldn't tell with any precision. Perhaps it was connected with prosperity and family cares, with jealousy, with causes as yet unperceived. But in any event, their former close bonds of friendship had certainly grown looser. This morning, however, they talked away without the least reserve. They saw an unknown tern and speculated upon its affinities with terns they knew. They saw what might possibly have been a Latham's albatross in the extreme distance. The sun shone down upon them with increasing force. Once a boat was lowered down to tow the ship's head round when she'd not quite enough way on her to go about. Once they were desired to move further aft so that the awning might be spread. This would be a perfect day for Mrs. Oakes to take the air, observed Stephen. She's not been on deck since it began to blow. But unhappily it seemed that she hurt her head in the rough weather and must stay below for a while. I asked Oakes whether he would like me to see her, but he says it was only a bruise and a shaking. A lee lurch, no doubt. The hound, said Martin in a low, vehement voice. His face quite changed. The infernal young hound. He beats her. Captain Aubrey had not been making game of them. Day after day, the Surprise tried to work to windward, and sometimes by favour of the tide or a stronger breeze she gained a little, so that the ship at Anamooka could be seen even from the deck, only to lose it in the flat calm of the night. Although food was uncomfortably low, Jack didn't like to bear away for Tongatabu while a possible prize lay in the sight. A seaman, and even more an officer of the Royal Navy, was deeply attached to prizes, the only possible source of a fortune. But that love was not to be compared to the privateer's consuming passion, for his prize-taking was his whole way of life, his sole raison d'etre. The Surprises, therefore, now sailed the ship with the closest possible attention to every shift in the breeze, anticipating orders and keeping her full in spite of the fact that as the hours and days went by, the likelihood of that distant whaler being fair prize grew steadily less. She showed a provoking stolidity, a disinclination to try to escape by night. Morning after morning she was still there, her yards crossed, her sails bent. The mood in the surprise changed from cheerfulness to something not far from restless discontent with a tendency to be quarrelsome. On the evening of Thursday, after quarters, Mrs. Oakes came on deck again, sitting in her usual place by the taffrail. She had a black eye of some day's age, now ringed with yellow and green, and as a partial shade she wore a piece of cloth over her head, as though a close-reefed topsail breeze were blowing. "I hope I see you well, ma'am," said Stephen, bowing. "Mr. Oakes told us you had had a fall, and I should have called, had he not dissuaded me." "I wish you had, dear doctor," said Mrs. Oakes. "I've been sadly bored. It was nothing to make anyone keep her bed, only this squalid, ignoble black eye. But even if the dreadful weather hadn't kept me below, I felt I couldn't show myself looking like a female prize-fighter. I shouldn't really appear now if dark weren't falling fast." Jack came aft, made civil inquiries, and returned to his task of making a little windward progress in the most untoward circumstances. Pullings, Martin and West appeared, and they talked with a fair amount of animation, but it appeared to Stephen that whereas their dislike of one another, or at least the tension between them, had increased, their attentiveness to Clarissa had declined in much the same proportion as her looks. She, for her part, was particularly agreeable to them all, particularly winning. On later reflection, it seemed to him that this was too simple. There was also another emotion abroad, perhaps best defined as a want of regard. Just on whose part, he could scarcely say, nor could he recall any specific instance. Yet the impression was there, and it was strengthened next day not only by the tone of the officers, but by the attitude of some of the hands. Although many, indeed most, smiled upon her with the same genial warmth, there were some faces whose look was questioning, puzzled, even deliberately expressionless. The great matter of this next day, however, was the changing of the sails, each in turn for its lighter brother. Jack Aubrey, as sensitive as a cat to changes in the weather, had had the pricking of his thumbs confirmed by the barometer. But so far he couldn't tell the direction of the coming breeze, and rather than disappoint all hands, he had merely given the order. And since the surprise owned a full wardrobe of well over 30, a great deal of activity was called for. Quite why, Stephen couldn't make out. The present suit of sail seemed perfectly adequate to him. But what he could make out, and make out quite clearly, was that when the captain was not on deck, there was much more damning of eyes and limbs than usual, and much more of the wrangling and contention and reluctant obedience, not uncommon in a privateer, but rare and very dangerous in the Royal Navy. He also made out the fact that for one foremast Jack who looked askance at Clarissa, there were half a dozen who cast a cold eye on Oakes. Yet it was not when Oakes was on duty that Jack, leaning over the side with Adams to measure the salinity, heard a voice float down from the fore crosstrees in answer to the cry, "Don't you know you must pass the selvagee first, damn your eyes?" A low voice, but perfectly distinct, "Who the devil cares what you say?" Jack looked up, said, "Mr. West, take that man's name," and carried on with his task. His breeze began to blow from the south, right on the frigate's beam, late in the forenoon watch. By the time the hands were piped to dinner, the water was singing down her side. Her deck had a slope of some 10 or 12 degrees, and the whole mood aboard had changed. Laughter, merriment. By the time the hands had eaten their dinner, the island was so much nearer that it filled the eighth part of the horizon, and a fine great pahi, a double canoe with a deckhouse, could be seen putting off the shore, hoisting its immense peaked sail and coming out to meet them on the opposite tack. "Killick," said Jack, Rouse out my box of red feathers, the chest of island presents, and whatever we have left in the way of sweetmeats. Sir, said Oakes, Masthead says there's a white man aboard. In a coat? Yes, sir, and a hat. Very good, Mr. Oakes, thank you. Killick, the lightest coat you can find, number 3 scraper and a clean pair of duck trousers, and pass the word for Captain Pullings. Tom, you know the South Sea Islanders as well as I do. They're delightful creatures, but nobody is to be allowed below except those that I invite into the cabin, and anything movable on deck is to be screwed down, including the anchor. Doctor, of our people, who do you think speaks South Seas best, being at the same time intelligent, if possible? There's the boatswain, but he might prove a little over-facetious as an interpreter. I should suggest Owen, or John Brampton, or Craddock. Tom Pullings had barely time to make the ship presentable, and Captain Aubrey had spent no more than 5 minutes on the spotless deck in his spotless trousers before the swift-sailing Pahi was within hail. The Surprise heaved to with her main topsail laid to the mast, and the canoe, with naval politeness, ran under her stern and came close up along her leeward side. Smiling brown faces gazed up, and an anxious white one. A young woman threw a sheaf of some strong-smelling green herb on deck. Lines were passed, and the white man came up the side, accompanied by an islander. Captain Aubrey, sir, I believe, said the white man, advancing and taking off his hat. My name is Wainwright, master of the Daisy Whaler, and this is Pakia, the under-chief of Tiaro. He brings you a present of fish, fruit and vegetables. I'm very kind of him, said Jack, smiling at Pakia, a tall, stout, beautifully tattooed young man, shining with oil, who smiled back in the friendliest manner. Please thank him heartily for me. Nothing could have been more welcome. And having named his officers and asked Pullings to have the presents brought aboard, Jack went on, will you step into the cabin? In the cabin, Killick handed some little round farinaceous objects fresh from the galley, spread with marmalade and Madeira. And after a few insignificant remarks, Jack opened a drawer, showed Wainwright a bunch of red feathers, asking in an aside, are they adequate? Oh, Lord, yes, said Wainwright. Oh, Lord, yes, said Pakia. Jack handed them to him together with a piece of scarlet cloth and a small magnifying glass. Pakia raised the gifts to his head with a face full of pleasure and made quite a long speech in Polynesian. I'm afraid I don't understand you, sir, said Jack, having listened attentively. Pakia says he hopes you will come ashore. He does not speak English, but he can echo the last words he hears with wonderful accuracy. Please tell him I should be very happy to come ashore to water and trade for hogs, coconuts and yams, and to walk about this beautiful island. Wainwright translated this and some further civilities, and then he said, for my own part, I'm delighted that you'll be coming. I have some very grave information for you. And aside from that, my own ship is in a sad way for want of the carpenter and his mate and the cooper. As soon as I saw the Surprise heave up, I said to Canning, my God, we're saved. How did you know she was the Surprise? Bless you, sir, there's no mistaking that towering mainmast. And in any case, we've sailed in company many a time in the Channel and the West Indies. Often came aboard you in the Mediterranean with messages from the flag. I served my time as midshipman and master's mate and passed for lieutenant in 98. But they never would give me a commission, so in the end I bore up for the merchant service. Like many another first-rate officer, said Jack, shaking his hand. You're very good, sir, said Wainwright. But since you're coming in, perhaps I may stay aboard, give you my important news, and then show you the channel through the reef while Pakia takes his people back in the Pahi. They're apt to be a nuisance on deck when it comes to the fine work of threading the channel and dropping anchor. During this time, the young chief, overcoming his natural gaiety, had sat with the gravity that became his rank, secretly counting his feathers and looking at them and the cloth through the magnifying glass, whose use he had grasped at once. On deck, however, there was no gravity at all, except on the part of Sarah and Emily. Once the fish, the yams, sugarcane, bananas and breadfruit had been brought aboard, most of the islanders followed them, leaving only a few to fend off. All the surprises who had a word of Polynesian, and at least a score of them were moderately fluent, entered into conversation. And those who hadn't did the same, contenting themselves with incorrect English spoken loud. Me like 'em banana. Good. Good. There were three young friendly women, who had also had time to oil themselves afresh, which gave their bare torsos a charming gleam, and to ornament their persons with necklaces of flowers and shark's teeth. But the foremast jacks were shy of accosting them with the officers present, and in any case they seemed strongly aware of rank. One spoke only to Pullings in his fine blue coat, one to Oakes and Clarissa, and one attached herself to Stephen, sitting by him on the carriage of a gun and entertaining him with a cheerful, very voluble account of some recent occurrence, often laughing as she did so and patting him on the knee. From the very frequent repetition of certain phrases, Stephen was convinced that she was recounting a conversation. So I said to him, and he said to me, so then I replied, oh, says he. Her bubbling high spirits were agreeable for a while, but presently he led her, still talking, to the forecastle where the little girls, and not so very little either now that they'd begun to shoot up, were watching the scene with displeasure. Jemmy Ducks had told them they were never to say black buggers again, as it was not genteel, but these were the words they muttered from time to time. Stephen said they were to curtsy, and that if the young lady wished to touch noses, they were to suffer it. This the young woman did, as the most natural thing in the world, very gently, bending a little, and then she addressed them in Polynesian. Finding they didn't understand, she laughed heartily, gave Emily one of her necklaces and Sarah a mother-of-pearl pendant, and continued her flow of speech, pointing now at the island, now at the masthead, and laughing very often. Presently Jack, Wainwright, and Pakia came on deck, and the young chief called out with surprising authority. All the islanders began to leave the ship, and Parsons, one of the South Seas speakers, said privately to Stephen, "By your leave, sir, that young female prigged your wipe while you was a-looking at the mast. Shall I tell her to give it back?"
"Did she indeed, Parsons?"
cried Stephen, clapping his hand to his pocket in a very simple way. "Well, never mind. It was an old torn rag of a thing, and I don't grudge it to so pretty a creature. But," he added inwardly, "she also took my little lancet, which I rather regret." The pie he shoved off filled and ran smoothly for the shore at an extraordinary pace, making almost no wake, and because of its wide-spaced double hull, scarcely heeling at all. In addition to the modest voluntary presence, it carried five handkerchiefs, one pocket lancet, two glass bottles, one with a coloured stopper, and one tobacco box, five iron and two wooden belaying pins. Yet what the islanders had brought so very far outweighed what they'd taken that it was impossible for any except the man deprived of his tobacco to feel righteous or indignant. "Now, sir," said Wainwright, they having returned to the cabin, "I must tell you that there is an English ship and several English seamen detained in the island of Oahu, which lies south of..."
"I know its position,"
said Jack, "but I have no accurate chart. Perhaps I'd better start by saying that my owners have six ships employed as whalers or as fur traders to Nootka Sound and the northwards, and these ships often appoint to meet, and others do the same, it being so convenient, at Oahu to refresh and exchange news or owner's instructions before going on either to Canton for the Nootka ships or down into the Southern Ocean for the rest of their whaling crews, right down, sometimes by way of Sydney Cove, to Van Diemen's Land or beyond. And if the fur traders haven't done well in their first season, they lie there and sail back early in the next, before the Americans come round the Horn. Most of the year, when the northeast trades are blowing, we put into Oahu, but the rest of the time we lie at Pabe in the north. "Will you draw me a rough map?" asked Jack, passing pencil and paper. "It's easy enough where Oahu is concerned," said Wainwright, and he drew a large figure of eight with a broad waist. "North to south is about 20 miles. The smaller lobe at the top, with the harbour of Pabe in the northeast, is Kalahua's territory. The division between the two rounds is very rough mountain country with forest going far down each side. The southern lobe belongs to Puolani. Rightly speaking, she's queen of the whole island, but some generations ago the chiefs in the north rebelled, and now Kalahua, who has knocked all the other northern chiefs on the head, says he is the rightful king of all Oahu, Puolani having eaten pork, which is taboo to women. Everyone says that's nonsense. She certainly eats the usual pieces of enemy chiefs killed in battle according to custom, but she is a very pious woman and would never touch pork. So you see, sir, there's a war between north and south. Our owners have told us to keep out of it because we have to use the two harbours, Pabe in the northeast, a good harbour in a deep inlet with a stream at its head when the wet south winds are blowing, and Oahu in the south in Puolani's country when the trades make it difficult to get out of Pabe. For my own part, I should have backed Puolani, who has always been kind to us and true to her word, and who is, after all, only a poor, weak woman, whereas Kalahua's an ugly scrub not to be trusted. The forces used to be about equal, and both sides treated us civilly. But when I came into Pabe this last time to join our ship's True Love, William Hardy and Heartsease John Trumper, I found everything was changed. Kalahua had a parcel of Europeans, some with muskets, and he'd fallen out with our two skippers. He wanted to, what he called, borrow their guns. But he didn't ask right out and make a point of it until Hardy was in a very awkward position, having heaved down his ship to come at a leak. They were still temporising when I came in, but by then Kalahua had seized a score of their men on one pretext or another. Theft, fornication, by God, touching taboo fruits or trees. And when I went to see him, he declared the ship should have no water, no supplies, and the men shouldn't be released until his demands were satisfied. There was something odd and false and disagreeably confident about him, and he kept on putting off our meetings. He was gone up country, he was sleeping, he was out of sorts. It was when he was really gone up into the mountains with his Europeans that a fourth ship of ours, the Cowslip, Michael McPhee, appeared in the offing. I signalled to her not to cross the bar and sent off one of our Kanaka hands with a message telling McPhee to water at Oahu, Puolani's harbour, if necessary, and then to pelt down to Sydney Cove like smoke and oakum and tell them how we were being used. Before Kalahua returned, a couple of big pahis came in. One of them belonging to an old friend of mine, a very good friend, an Oahu chief, last from Molokai in the Sandwich Islands, and I learned why Kalahua was so confident. He was expecting the Franklin, a heavy privateer carrying 22 nine-pounders, sailing under the American flag but manned by Frenchmen from Canada and Louisiana. And, to be sure, though Kalahua had kept his white men from us, I had seen something of them, and they certainly spoke French among themselves, or, when they saw me, a damned odd sort of English. And I heard that the French owner, who had been in Hawaii picking up hands, was a man who couldn't keep quiet, who had to be talking, and he'd told a handsome Marquesas girl, half French herself, that he didn't value Callahoo a pinch of snuff, an odious fellow, false through and through, and that as soon as the two sides, north and south, had weakened one another enough, Callahoo should be knocked on the head, Puolani's war canoes, her chief strength, should be destroyed with a couple of broadsides, and that Mauahu, at the wish of its people and of those surviving chiefs who knew what was good for them, should be declared a French possession. The natives would be taught to cry Vive l'Empereur, which was fair enough, since it was the French government that had put up the money for the ship. But once the war was over, there would be quite a different regime, with equality for everyone, all property held in common, justice, peace and plenty, everything settled by discussion.
That puts a different face on the matter, said Jack, thinking of Stephen with great relief.
Yes, sir. So I posted a sentinel to watch for the Franklin. There was nothing to be done about the True Love. She was hove down right in the village, and in any case the tide wouldn't serve. But Trumper of the Heartsease and I prepared our ships as well as we could, though we only had what you expect in merchantmen. And that same evening the sentinel came hallooing down. There was a ship in with the land, making for the harbour under an easy sail. We'd been delayed so long the trades were blowing again. The wind was northeasterly, but by the grace of God there was just enough north in it to let us scrape past the South Headland close-hauled.
Heartsease went first, and she got off with no more than a hole or two in her topsails. But the Franklin cracked on to make all sneer again, throwing a bow wave as wide as our forecourse and ranging up fast. The Daisy was never built for speed, and he gave us a broadside that killed our carpenter and his mate and shattered the boats on the boom.
As cruel a broadside as ever I saw, and I thought if this goes on I shall have to strike. But it was only luck. His next went overhead, and before he could fire again, damn slow, I may say, by your standards, sir, I had the satisfaction of seeing his fore topmast go by the board. I like to think it was the stern chaser I'd just fired that cut the backstay, but it was more likely an absurd overpress of sail. Genegate came up into the wind, and he'd knocked the command of his helm to follow me through the dogleg passage in the reef. The way had been coming off the frigate for some time now, and Wainwright, glancing at the shore, said, "Speaking of channels, perhaps I should show your helmsman just how this one lies. We're quite near, and it's no good following the Pai. They never can believe we draw so much water." On deck, Jack found that they had indeed come very close to the reef. There were leadsmen in the chains on either side. Davidge was on the foretopsail yard conning the ship. Pullings had hands at the braces and halyards, with the anchor dangling a cockbill. "Captain Wainwright will take her in," said Jack to Pullings. And Wainwright, guiding himself by familiar landmarks, set about the awkward turns with such obvious competence that all hands relaxed. All hands, that's to say, except the medical men and Clarissa Oakes. For her part, she'd never supposed that there was any danger, and her whole being was taken up with the shore, its brilliant coral strand, its coconut palms leaning in every direction, their fronds streaming with infinite grace, the village of widespread little houses among irregular fields and gardens, a path leading into the green forest. Maturin's and Martin's eyes and telescopes, on the other hand, were fixed upon the whaler, lying close inshore, leaning heavily. She had a stage over her side. I believe it's an ancient murrelet, but I saw it on the water.
How could you speak so, Maturin, said Martin, an ancient murrelet in these latitudes?
That's certainly an auk, said Stephen, following its rapid, whirring flight, and I'm persuaded it's an ancient murrelet.
See, cried Martin, it circles the ship, it lands in the foretop.
The frigate had passed through the channel, and she was gliding gently towards the whaler. Wainwright brought her head to the wind, called, "Let go!" The anchor splashed into the sea, that welcome, welcome sound, and the Surprise drifted on with the making tide, paying out a good scope of cable, and bringing up been a comfortable 5 fathom water, so close to the whaler that the bird could be clearly seen, watching them with every appearance of curiosity.
"If you'll come across and dine with me, sir," said Wainwright, "I'll finish my account. I'm so sorry I cannot invite your officers, but the Daisy's cabin is crammed with the more valuable bales from the True Love, and there's barely room for even 2 to sit down."
"I should be very happy," said Jack, "but first may I beg you to ask Pakia to tell his people they mustn't come aboard until he gives the word. Mr. Davidge, my gig. Captain Pullings, I'm going aboard the whaler. There's to be no trading for curiosities until the ship has been victualled."
While the boat was lowering down, Stephen, from the gangway, said, "Captain Aubrey, sir, I appeal to you. Is not that bird on the edge of the whaler's front platform, top, foretop, an ancient murrelet?"
"Why," said Jack, considering it, "I'm no expert, as you're aware, but perhaps it does look a little elderly. Can it be et?"
"Certainly it's an ancient murrelet, Doctor," said Wainwright. "It's our surgeon's ancient murrelet, Agnes. He brought her up from the egg. If you'd like to come across with us, I'm sure he'd be happy to show her to you."
"I will not importune you at the moment, sir," said Stephen, "but I have a little small skiff of my own, and with your permission I shall wait upon the gentleman somewhat later in the day."
"And so, sir, a trifle of crackling?"
"If you please," said Jack, holding out his plate. "How I love roast pork." "And so, sir, having left the Franklin astern, I ran as fast as I could to catch up with Heartsease. But that was not very fast, because the privateer's unlucky broadside had caught us on the heel well below the waterline, and with the larboard tack aboard, the water came spurting in like 3 conduits under anything more than close-reefed topsails. In any case, the weather turned thick and dirty that night. We never saw the Heartsease again, though we kept pegging away with all the sails she could bear, pumping all day and most of the night. We managed to follow the worst of the leaks for a while and stuff some of the rest inboard, but heavy seas undid all our work after some 10 days or so, and the hands were dropping with fatigue, so I was obliged to haul up for Anamooka. But how I hope the Heartsease reached Sydney Cove."
"She did," said Jack. "And in consequence of her report, I've been sent to deal with the situation. I am now proceeding to Oahu with all possible dispatch."
"Oh," said Captain Wainwright, laying down his knife and fork and gazing at Captain Aubrey. "Are you, by God? I'm prodigious glad of it for those poor men we had to leave behind, and for my owners too, of course. The True Love is a fine new vessel, Whitby built, with a valuable cargo, apart from what we took out. May I come with you? The Daisy may not carry very heavy metal, but I know those waters, I know the people, I speak the language, and we have 19 prime seamen as well as the officers."
"That's a most obliging offer," said Jack, "but in this case speed is everything. A few degrees north, we should find the trades blowing hard and steady, and the Surprise is happiest on a bowline. In those latitudes, she's logged well over 200 miles between noon and noon, day after day, and I fear the Daisy couldn't keep up, even if she were in a fit state to sail."
"She has made 7 knots with the wind on her quarter," said Wainwright, "but I must admit there's no comparison."
"I hope to catch him at anchor," said Jack. "No great seaman, I believe you said?"
"That was my impression, sir. I'm told he hasn't cruised before, and is a somewhat philosophical, theoretical gent."
"Then the sooner his capers are cut short, the better. Let us have no benevolent revolutions, no humanitarians, no goddamn systems, no panaceas. Look at that wicked fellow Cromwell and those vile Whigs in poor King James's time. A fine seaman as he was, too. But tell me, what does your damage amount to?"
"Oh, sir," replied Wainwright, brightening, "I doubt there's much more than a day's work for a skilled carpenter and his crew. If we could but have the worst look to, and just one boat patched so that it might swim."
"Then if you'll pass the word for my coxswain, I'll send him to bring Mr. Bentley. A capital hand with a shot plug or a fractured knee."
In Dr. Falconer, the Daisy's surgeon, Stephen and Martin found a man after their own hearts. He'd abandoned a lucrative practice in Oxford as soon as a modest competence was put by, and he took to the sea in his cousin's various ships for the sake of natural philosophy. Volcanoes and birds were his chief delight, but nothing came amiss, and he dissected the narwhal and the white bear of the north and the sea elephant of the far south. Yet his interest in medicine, theoretical and practical, was undiminished. And as the two vessels were warping across the harbour to lie side by side for the benefit of the carpenters, they abandoned all ethology for the moment and turned to hydrophobia. Hydrophobia, philosophically considered, some of the cases they'd known, and the variety of treatments. I remember a strong boy of 14 who was admitted to the infirmary having been bit that day month by a mad foxhound, said Dr. Falconer. There's a yellow-billed tropic bird. The day after he was bit, he went to sea, where he was dipped with all the severity usually practised under so disagreeable an operation. A common adhesive plaster was applied to the part after the sea-bathing, and in the course of a month the wound was healed, except a small portion somewhat more than an inch in length, and in breadth about one-tenth. It was in quite a cicatrising state. 5 days before he was admitted, he began to complain of a tightness over his temples and a pain in his head. In 2 days, the hydrophobia began to appear. The disease was pretty strong when he came to the infirmary. He was given a bolus of a scruple of musk with 2 grains of opium, then a composition of 15 grains of musk, 1 of turpeth mineral, and 5 grains of opium every third hour. An ounce of the stronger mercurial ointment was rubbed on the cervical vertebrae, and an embrocation of 2 ounces of laudanum and 1/2 ounce of acetum saturninum was directed to be applied to the throat. But by this last he was thrown into convulsions, and the same effect followed, though his eyes were covered with a napkin. The embrocation was therefore changed for a plaster of powdered camphor, 1/2 ounce of opium, and 6 drachms of Confectio Damocritus. What was the outcome? Asked Stephen. The disease seemed somewhat suspended, but the symptoms returned with violence in the evening. His medicine was repeated at 7, and at 8, 5 grains of opium were exhibited without musk or turpeth. At 9, another ounce of mercurial ointment was rubbed upon the shoulders. At 1/2 ounce of laudanum with 6 ounces of mutton broth was injected into the intestines, but to no purpose. A larger dose of opium was then given, but with as little effect as the former. And he died the same night. My experience has been much the same, alas, said Stephen, except in one case at Oughterard near Connacht, where 2 bottles of whisky drunk at stated intervals during the course of 1 day appeared to effect a radical cure. I'm not to speak of physic in the presence of 2 doctors of medicine, said Martin, but I was once present when an embrocation of 1/2 ounce of sal ammoniac, 10 drachms of olive oil, 6 drachms of oil of amber, and 10 drachms of laudanum was applied. The 2 ships came together with a gentle, elastic thump. Martin raised his voice above the nautical cries and the laughter from the swarm of friendly canoes, some paddled by children and very nearly crushed between the sides. Strong mercurial ointment on shoulder and back, as in Dr. Falconer's case, and to induce tirelessness even more speedily, the patient received the smoke of cinnabar into the mouth. Above their heads, Bulkley started his call, the shrill, urgent pipe of all hands on deck, followed by his hoarse roar of all hands on deck, all hands aft, look alive, you dormice. Then Pulling's voice, silence fore and aft. And after a pause, Captain Aubrey said, shipmates, we must run north as soon as ever the ship can be watered and victualled. We shall start watering directly, then tonight half of each mess may have a run on shore. Tomorrow we shall complete our water and start trading, and tomorrow night the other half may have leave. The next day
After trading again in the morning, we must get underway at the beginning of ebb. There's not a moment to be lost.